This is Evolutionary Radio. This is your host, Trevor Kuritzen. Joining me, as always, is my faithful co-host, Steve Smee.
Hey, guys. Good afternoon. We have a special guest again coming your way in the video coming ahead.
This guest is someone I'm really looking forward to. It's someone who I've followed for a very long time, someone I've read all of his books, Mr. Scott Abel. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be here. I always like being a guest on these shows and try to expand my horizons, so this is great.
Okay, so Mr. Abel, I feel it's a shame that more people in the bodybuilding community don't know who you are. And I think a large part of that is because you've kind of gotten out of the bodybuilding scene the last 10 years. Can you give us your story? Give us, you know, we've got lots of time here. Tell us, you know, what got you into lifting weights in the first place? What got you into bodybuilding? And then what made you decide to, you know, get out of the industry and, you know, just basically be done with it?
Well, it depends on how wide scope people want to call out of the industry, right? Like, I would say I'm still in the physique transformation business. I would say I'm still very much in the fitness business. I'm very much still in the weight loss and healthy living business. But I'm done with the hardcore bodybuilding element and the subculture of hardcore bodybuilding. I guess you could say I was the face of it for a lot of years, which I was never comfortable with. And the bodybuilding subculture, I mean, they put the word cult in subculture. And it's something that, you know, you start something for one reason, you continue it for another. And then after a while, as a mature, intelligent person, I just couldn't justify anymore. You know, the old thing, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. So between the ever escalating arms race of performance enhancing drugs, people were starting to die around me. Figure and bikini and stuff had just started. So there was the whole ramifications of just en masse metabolic damage and things like that that I was witnessing. And it just became more and more the lunatic fringe. And as the saying goes, you know, I'd been to the top of that mountain. I looked over the summit. I didn't like the view, so I crawled back down. So I think people, especially this generation who don't know who I was in that capacity before the internet. I mean, I was in the magazines. I had a column in the magazines. I had earned the respect of the most important people in the industry. So it wasn't like I was just in the bodybuilding industry. I was in the very top levels of it behind the scenes with supplement companies. And that's another story too. A reason I wanted to get out is the whole hoodwink, let's take advantage of the consumer rather than try to help the consumer kind of approach of the supplement industry. It's all about getting rich. It's not about getting results for people. There was just too many negatives that started adding up. And then when people started dying, I just couldn't, you know. And there was other things like as a columnist and a ghostwriter for a few of the magazines. At one point, Robert Kennedy and his right-hand man, readers would have known him as Johnny Fitness, but his real name was Gino Edwards. They wanted me to write a whole like 5-6-part series of articles on steroids and stuff, history and how to take them and all this stuff that was going to run for a whole year. And I just didn't want to be pigeonholed as that guy. Like, I didn't get into this to be a chemist. I got into this to enhance my life and be a better person and personal growth and all that kind of stuff. And it was just going in such an opposite direction that I just wasn't comfortable with it anymore. So
me and Steve know firsthand what you're talking about. You know, we're both moderators on the forums, and you know, forums now are huge, and you know, at least once a day someone will post a thread saying, you know, hey, I've been working out 3 months, I'm about to start my first steroid cycle, what do you, and it's like, you've been working out 3 months?
Yeah.
You're still on the trial membership. Like, do you, like, have you even tried every piece of equipment in the gym? You know what I mean? Or another thing is, all the time I get these email consultations from bikini girls. And, you know, they're looking to do bikini. And, like, their past coach had them on T3, clenbuterol, And I'm like, you're doing bikini. Like you don't need drugs to do bikini. Now, if you want to be the next, you know, female Miss Olympia, then obviously, you know, steroids are going to be part of the equation. But I mean, if you're
they're part of the equation at every level now. See, this was part of the ongoing snowball effect that I saw, because I was around before there was anything except female bodybuilding. And then that morphed into female fitness. And the whole history here is, I've set it up on a bunch of shows that I've been on, but what happened here was there wasn't enough ladies who wanted to get away from the female bodybuilding and wanted to do the female fitness. They didn't have a cheerleader or a gymnastics background because it required routines and you had to have specific moves and strength moves and things like that. So it left a lot of ladies out. So what did they do? They dumbed it down again. And what did they dumb it down to? Female figure, looking for the basic same structure that you look for in men, which is another topic altogether. But, you know, cap shoulders, V taper. Slim at the waist. Basically, Robert Kennedy used to say his figure is about looking like a 12-year-old boy with implants. So then that transferred into, there wasn't enough ladies who had the physical structure, because like most women are narrower in the clavicles and wider in the pelvis. That's just the way the human female evolved. So they didn't fit the classic symmetry, so they started bikini. So gradually what happened was, the more they opened up these classes, the more of a cash cow it was for promoters. Bodybuilding as a competition industry was on its deathbed. Like, there was really nothing happening at local contests and stuff like that. Opening up the figure categories to where it didn't require any talent at all, that became a cash cow and continues to be a cash cow to this day. The problem there is it really, really exploits the female and the female competitor at all levels. Like, it's costing ladies now upwards of $2,000-$3,000 to compete. Now I'm like, well, shouldn't you be making money from the fitness industry if that's what your sworn profession is, instead of being drained of, you know, I have ladies writing me, they're broke after 3 or 4 competitions, and not only broke, but they're broken. Their metabolisms are shot. And then there's the whole nonsense of the cult of the industry. Like, I've raved about and ranted about on my own podcast where it's gotten so ridiculous now that in figure competitions, you have posing coaches. All right. Now, in figure competition, all you have to do is turn to the side 3 times. I mean, this isn't rocket science, but for some unknown reason, we need coaches to help a lady turn 3 times to the side in heels and decide how she looks best. And I think it's just a continued exploitation of the female, you know, desire to look a certain way or fit into a certain schema or mold. And, the more it got dumbed down, the more ridiculous it just seemed to get to me. So it was another reason, like, I just, like, shake my head, roll my eyes.
Mr. Abel, this is one of the biggest pet peeves I have when it comes to a bodybuilding competition. So when you have a bodybuilding competition, they charge the competitors. You know, the competitors not only have to buy a yearly membership to the organization, then they also have to pay, you know, their entry fee. Usually it's about $100 for the membership and about $150 for the entry fee. Then at the show, they also charge all the spectators. So they're charging, you know, that person's girlfriend, husband, wife, kids, mother, father, whatever. And these tickets are expensive. You know, they're normally $50 to $80. And you have to buy a ticket for both the pre-judging and the night show.
And let's not forget, many of these competitors traveling to these shows, so they got to stay in hotels. And there's that expense too.
I'm just talking about local show. And then for all those, you know, supplement booths or, you know, whatever who are sponsoring the show, they charge them as well. So, I mean, they're charging everyone. Like, what I think they should do is either charge the competitors and it's free to watch, or the competitors can enter for free and then you charge the spectators. You don't charge everyone. Like, that's robbing everyone. And that's why the sport's dying, because, you know, let's say I want to do a show. It's going to, you know, when it's all said and done, it's going to cost me maybe, you know, $600-$700 once you add up your spray tan and your posing trunks and everything. Then it's going to cost my family, you know, a couple $100 just to watch the show. And that's if that show's even in my city. If it's not, then you have to add up travel. Then you have to add up hotel. Then you have to add up, you know, eating out. That's why the sport's dying.
It's going to cost you way more than the number you just said, because no one's going to compete without a coach. And then the coach is going to try to sell supplements and pharmaceuticals, et cetera, et cetera, to line their pockets. That's what I'm saying. The exploitation of the female competitor is anyone who possibly can has their hands in their pockets, including their families, because families come to support them and see them and you know, all the rest of it. But so, yeah, it's you're never going to convince people that it's dying now, because they keep splintering all these classes. Like, now they have male classic physique and all these things. So they're doing everything they can to expand, you know, the categories to have more and more people pay, like you said, pay their entry fee, and then their families come to support them. So it's a big cash cow. You know, some of these figure classes, bikini classes, that are like 30 people deep. So you think 30 people just in one category paid their entry fee. That's a pretty huge cash cow for the promoter, but it's a huge exploitation of the competitor. And that just bothers me.
So Mr. Abel, one of the main reasons I want to get you on the show.
Call me Coach or call me Scott. I'm not comfortable with Mr. Okay.
I'll call you Coach. Okay. Sorry, I just looked up to you for such a long time. I'm excited to get you on. So one of the reasons both me and Steve really want to get you on is that you take a different approach to fat loss. You know, most people, when you say, hey, you want to lose fat? Simple. Calories in, calories out. You either got to eat less, move more, or do both. You, on the other hand, you talk about, you know, the importance of building a metabolic furnace, the importance that, you know, a calorie is not a calorie. What you eat is just as important as how much. It's all about, you know, small meals throughout the day. It's not about, you know, exhausting yourself with cardio. I wanted to hear your thoughts on, you know, just what you recommend for fat loss, some of the most common mistakes you see people make. And then Steve, he's a big advocate of intermittent fasting. I want to know what your thoughts on intermittent fasting are. I personally don't really like it, but I just like to hear, you know, what your thoughts are, you know, having been in the industries for so long.
Oh, that's a loaded thing. Which one? Well, I've always taken the inside out approach, because that's how I got to the top of the industry. So I was looking at, I was fortunate, because as I was becoming a person of note in the industry, I was in the industry, but not of the industry, meaning I wasn't part of the subculture. I was going to school. I was in graduate school. I had all kinds of other things. So I sort of became aware of what was going on around me when I was at the competitions and things like that, and realized that people were doing it a lot different than me, but they weren't getting anywhere. You know, one of the few people that was actually making progress year to year was me. I also had, you know, a fantastic mentor in Bill Pearl, who was like the first true superstar of fitness and bodybuilding, who took me under his wings. That was a big deal. So since then, it was all about unraveling what has been generations long approach of selling people from the outside in. You know, whatever your struggle is, the answer is outside of you. It's on a grocery store shelf. It's on a GNC shelf. It's on a FitPal app. It's on all these other things that try to give you what I call the illusion of control, this outside in approach to all of it. So, I'm gonna watch my macros, and I'm gonna make things fit my macros, or I'm gonna do intermittent fasting, or, you know, I'm gonna equate this many calories. Well, we already know that thermodynamics is true. It works, but it works to a certain level. It doesn't work to a certain level of exactness. And calories do not measure metabolism. Calories measure a unit of heat. So there's all, this is the best we have, so we use it. But calories can vary as much as 20 to 40%. If you have the exact same size apple, depending on when it was harvested and where it was grown in the apple orchard, the calorie content of that and the available energy for use by the body, which is a different thing, that can vary as much as 40%, even though it's the exact same size and species of apple. So we have this going on throughout the industry, and yet people are endlessly being trying to convinced to work from the outside in and dictate to your body. And I've said all along, that's a mistake. That's where people get into trouble. It may be an okay starting point, but it's certainly something you want to graduate from as soon as possible. I call that level the kindergarten level. People tend to stay at that level for a lifetime, where you really want to get to the biofeedback level, where you're in touch with your body and it's the way it communicates with you through all its ways and avenues that it does. Pain receptors, hunger, appetite, satiety, things like that. Those are the things that keep you in a sustainable environment. The other issue currently in the industry is everything is about breaking down the body, right? So be in a calorie deficit all the time. treat certain hormones like they're monsters and bad guys, like insulin and cortisol. Insulin is a very anabolic hormone. Certain biochemistry and hormones are meant to exist in a checks and balances system. If you tip that scale too much toward breaking down tissue in a catabolic state, then you're doing a different thing than just losing fat. You're also compromising metabolism over the long term. Now, to get to, I mean, I can go on about this stuff as well for as many hours as you want, but to get to intermittent fasting, on my level of study and consternation, I consider it no more than a gimmick. I consider it a fad diet. And the reason being is, if you look at the history, there isn't really as much accurate reporting of intermittent fasting culturally, historically, as you're led to believe. I wrote an article called Intermittent Fasting, the Diet of Sumo Wrestlers, because sumo wrestlers are intermittent fasters. They tend to eat later in the day. They eat as much as they can at that meal. Regardless of how many calories they're taking in, you're looking at elements of a huge insulin spike, things like that. Once you go over a certain size bolus being the size of a meal that you're taking in, then any excess calories that can't be assimilated and processed will be stored. That's what insulin does. Insulin is a stored hormone with bias. So if you want to create insulin sensitivity, you do that through frequent small meals, and you do that through exercise. So intermittent fasting, I find, is another way where we tend to think negatively about diet. Oh, the less times we eat, well, that's another thing I'm subtracting, right? Everything in this industry seems to be about denying and depriving. So, ooh, if I'm intermittent fasting, especially for the women, well, now I'm only eating once or twice a day. That's a good thing. Well, that's not necessarily a good thing. You have to fuel metabolism, all right? You can't keep downgrading, repressing, and oppressing metabolism, because when you do, then any fat loss you've lost, there's going to be repercussions for that down the road. And people don't realize that the metabolic compensation system, the metabolic adaptation system, it works in long-term frames of time. It doesn't work in short-term frames of time. But in this industry, in the diet industry, they work almost entirely in short-term frames of time. And that's why people will come out and say, keto works or intermittent fasting works, because they have short-term anecdotal evidence. And people want to wave a flag of any fad thing they're doing, because we have three realms of time we need to consider metabolically: the immediate, the residual, and the cumulative. So in the immediate, you'll get people, you know, flag waving for keto, flag waving for if it fits your macros, flag waving for intermittent fasting. And they go on social media presenting anecdotal evidence in the short term. And what happens is, over the long term, when they've gained all that weight back, they're not going to go on social media and embarrass themselves and show what happened to them 12 months later. Like, there's a difference. Like, I'm going to be posting something later in the week, but there's a, you know, I always opt for posting client social proof. My own clients, I seldom, if ever, use 12-week windows. I use at least 1, 2, 3 years and more windows that a client has transformed and kept the weight off. So I'm not interested in what someone can do in the short term to lose weight. I'm more interested in the proper way of what someone should do to sustain that weight over the long term. And I call that being the difference between being a weight loss tourist and a weight loss resident. There's a big difference there.
I agree completely with what you said. I'm going to chime in, then we'll let Steve chime in here.
Sure.
But, one thing that, you know, you really have to be careful with is, you know, on Instagram, people will post these before and after, you know, 16-week photos saying, hey, I did intermittent fasting, or I did keto, or whatever. And they look great in those end photos. Don't get me wrong. They look amazing. But what you don't see is they don't post photos 2 months after that showing the 30 pounds they ballooned up, you know. And I've had friends who, they basically hired a coach, go on a boatload of drugs, followed intermittent fasting or some sort of fad diet, you know, look great at their show. 2 months after their show, they're back up 40 pounds. They've got so much water retention, they can't even fit their shoes. So yeah, it's a lifestyle. It's not a diet.
Yeah, and this is the kind of thing. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I was just wondering your thoughts on intermittent fasting, because I know it's something that, you know, you're a big big proponent of. How long have you been doing intermittent fasting?
Actually, I don't intermittent fast. What I do is I fast once a week for 24 hours, and then I do like 5-day fasts, like twice a year. So that's been my strategy. So I don't actually, with intermittent fasting, I don't know what subject we're on. I guess we're on bodybuilding, physique, bikini, or whatever. For something like that, intermittent fasting or fasting is absurd. It's not going to work long term. It's not something that I'm doing to lose weight or for a fat or something. It's something I do to be healthy. It's a healthy thing. It's a way to detox my body. So that's the purpose between intermittent fasting. I think that's in, you know, and you know, Coach Scott, you're absolutely right on that. I totally agree. But the thing is, like, when people say intermittent fasting on social media or keto diet or all this stuff, they're not actually doing them right anyway. So like people, you know, I had a rant this morning on the forums about keto diet. People think keto, you can go eat lamb and steak and burgers and bacon, and they think that you're going to lose weight long term eating that shit because they think that's keto diet. And I don't believe that it is keto diet. I think if you want to truly get in ketosis, you just got to stop eating food and you'll be in ketosis after 2 or 3 days. So that's a totally different thing. But this is the thing I argue with people all the time about this. If you told me 3 months ago about fasting and all this shit, I would have told you it was stupid because my goals were different. But now my goals are more health, you know? So in that aspect, you know, that's the whole reason behind the fasting. But intermittent fasting is not going to work on people because like you said, sumo, the perfect example of the sumo wrestlers, they won't eat till 2 p.m. Then they'll fucking eat a shitload of food. They'll eat like 3,000-4,000 calories in that window. And then boom, you know, what are you really accomplishing in that time? So, you know, I'm with you on that. But, you know, we have to remember there's a difference between people who want to get on stage in a bikini, you know, and someone who just is doing this for health and vitality. So I think for the people listening, I just want to make sure. But let's instead of saying, you know, what doesn't work, this sucks, whatever. I'm curious, Coach. Because I've seen your YouTube videos, you've got a lot of good nutrition information. So what does work? If I want to get in shape, get lean, you know, in general, what does work in your
opinion? Let me just, I got to qualify here because the things that are being hinted at, I want to make sure people understand. I'm out of the competitive world. So when I was talking about answering previously the questions I was asked, intermittent fasting and all that, I'm talking about optimizing metabolism. I'm not talking about peaking competitors for contests. I've been out of that world since over a decade. So that's not my thing. That doesn't mean you throw away all the lessons that you learn along the way with that at being at the top of the industry. So that's important too. Now, this is your show, but I argue with you that cleanses and detoxes are also null and void in terms of metabolic effects and health, but that's another, you know, I'd have to gather my research for you, but you can check out T. Colin Campbell on that. He's I'm sure you know who he is, but 50 years of research, 50 years at the PhD level. That's the kind of research I trust, not the bro science online. But so what does work? Well, all kinds of things do work. One is a carb-based diet. You got to start with a carb-based diet, and that includes starches. We already know that paleo has been debunked and demystified. There's all kinds of TED Talks from actual anthropologists that say this paleo representation of how Paleolithic man ate is actually a fabrication. That's not how they ate. There's plenty of evidence of tools used to break down starch so it could be properly masticated. The other misleading elements of these kind of diets is that it implies that these Paleolithic human beings were quote unquote lean. They weren't lean, they were scrawny, they were starving, all right? They lived in a completely different human environment. You gotta remember, no refrigeration, no heat, no air conditioning, none of the things that settle and equalize a metabolism. So their profile of energy balance was all about eat food and then consume a whole whack of energy in trying to procure more food. There was no food storage. So people from that era were scrawny. They weren't very tall. They weren't very lean. They didn't have much strength. So trying to pretend that these people were something, you know, to try to emulate was already misleading in and of itself. And that's the problem with vogue trends in the diet industry. It's all about politics for profit. So bending and twisting research so it looks like you can qualify it as something new. So when really paleo was just a different graduation of Atkins, and I've been talking about that online as well, showing the history of all that kind of stuff from Atkins to Tobbs to paleo to, you know, whatever is next down the pike. But so let's go back. What works? Well, if you want to use insulin as a storage hormone with bias, that's the best way to describe it. It's not the hormone that makes you fat, as this industry wants people to think at a kindergarten level. Insulin is an anabolic hormone, meaning it stores, all right? It tells the body it's in a fed state. That's a good thing. So frequent small meals will keep insulin levels at bay rather than larger meals, which will create a bigger insulin dump. And that can lead to rebound hypoglycemia. It can lead to hyperinsulinemia, those kind of things. The low carb movement, ridiculous argument is that hyperinsulinemia is a marker for several disease states, which is absolutely true. Therefore, insulin as a hormone is the enemy. Well, that's like saying eating undercooked chicken causes salmonella, so we shouldn't eat chicken, right? It's just what we call a spurious claim. One has nothing to do with the other. So what happens is insulin isn't the monster hormone. The insulin receptor gets desensitized, and usually that's through becoming fat and gaining weight. So the solution to that is increased insulin sensitization. How? Frequent small meals and exercise. So a lot of the times this argument about insulin comes from the world of overweight and how to deal with overweight, and talk to people who aren't nutritionally informed, take that and use it as a scare tactic in the fitness industry to tell people who are already exercising and eating right that insulin is some kind of monster hormone. And hence we end up with all this low carb and fasting and cleansing and all the rest of the nonsense. So what works is the exact opposite of what's been marketing to work. You don't need anything overly complicated. You don't need carb backloading. You don't need, I mean, one of my biggest, targets is if it fits your macros, implying that 100 calories of Snickers bar is the same qualitatively inside your body as 100 calories of asparagus or apples. Those are qualitatively different things, and your body will digest them as such. So carb-based meals, small meals balanced throughout the day, and then thinking about metabolic optimization in a way where you realize that metabolism has to be fed, not starved. So all of these things that argue for the thermodynamics of less in, less calories in, more energy out, fail to understand that your metabolism will adapt to that over time, and it will downregulate. And then you're in a position where eating the amount of calories you're in anymore will no longer lead to weight loss and fat loss. As a matter of fact, from doing that, you trigger your system to go into fat storing machinery, factory making. Mm-hmm. And then when you start eating normally again, you're going to gain all the weight back. So I have a system. It doesn't apply for everybody, but it's called the cycle diet. I've been doing it for 30 years. My protege, Andy Sinclair, who's a fitness model, cover model, been on the cover of many magazines, et cetera, has 8-pack abs year round. He's on it as well. So what you do with the cycle diet is you cycle underfeeding, regular underfeeding with well-timed, what we call refeeds or spikes, or even what some people used to call cheat days. But you have to really overfeed that element. So then in that metabolic environment, metabolic context, you're counting on an insulin dump, because you know that insulin dump, insulin being a storage hormone with bias, will instruct those calories into the muscles and intracellular spaces where you want it. So you fill out, you replenish glycogen, which is a trigger to optimize metabolism. You also replenish leptin levels, which is to re-optimize fat burning. So you can't just diet. You have to diet at a relative calorie deficit, not an absolute one. Those are two different things. Get your body into what we call supercompensation mode, where it wants to overstore any extra calories that come in, and then rely on that using refeeds. Now, in my book, in my course, The Cycle Diet, I use as an example a lot of people from the competitive eating world, people that professionally go into eating contests, and all the ones that are lean, like the Black Widow, I used as an example. Like, here's a young Asian lady. She barely weighs 100 pounds. I think she weighs 90 pounds. She can eat 10 pounds of cheesecake in 10 minutes. Other things. People don't realize is that these competitive eaters who do it for a living, like any other sport, you have to practice being able to eat that much. How do you practice being able to eat that much is reflective of what I said about my cycle diet. Why are they able to compete in eating contests? If it was just about the law of thermodynamics, calories in, calories out, then every single eating competitor should be massively overweight. But there's lots of them that are really, really lean. So why is that the case? Well, they cycle regular underfeeding with regular well-timed overfeeding because they're in what I call super compensation metabolic mode. And that's something that I learned from my years in the bodybuilding world. Before the cycle diet even had a name, I was already engineering it. And I think it's on page one of my cycle diet book. One of the things I made a point of saying is the reason I love my cycle diet is it was born in the world of experience and not in a library. Every single diet you're going to read about 99% of the time is born in a library somewhere. Atkins, all these other people gathering research. Well, the cycle diet was born in the real world of bodybuilding, where competitors, 100% of the time, no matter who you were, you would compete, and then you would notice that for about a week or so, you had this window, no matter what you ate, you weren't getting fat, you were just filling out, and it was awesome, and everyone would be like, holy cow, like, I've got this week off, and I just feel great, and I look great, and I'm like, well, there's something to this, there's something that has to be happening there. Why is it, in one specific context, you can overfeed and overeat and nothing bad happens. But if you were to do that regularly, of course, you would just gain weight and be a big fat fatty. So there was something going on there. And what I did is I just reverse engineered it. And I got it down to what I call super compensation mode, which is putting your body in a storage mode of need where when you get the extra calories, it's not going to store them as fat. It's going to store them into glycogen stores intracellularly where you want them, cell volumization, things like that, but also triggers increasing metabolic rate. Again, those realms of time that I referred to earlier, the immediate, the residual, and the cumulative, after a massive refeed, what happens is your body doesn't have the capacity to deal with that many calories coming in at once. So it increases thermogenesis, the rate at which it burns calories, and we call that being situationally hypermetabolic. So you're actually, for the first few days after a refeed, you're actually in a hypermetabolic mode, burning more calories and fat than you normally would have been if you just had a regular off-diet meal. So it really, really works. Like, one of the things that's going to post any minute now on my Facebook page is sort of did a behind-the-scenes thing of the cycle diet with Andy, where for this week's cheat day, I bought him a 3-pound tub of double chocolate chip cookie dough. Now, here's a guy with 8-pack abs year round, but he has that because he's not depriving himself year round because no one can live that way. So what I've done is create a diet where you can live in the real world of food abundance and not be afraid of food and actually have it work for you in a very anabolic way, in a way that optimizes metabolism rather than down-regulating it. Sorry, that's a really long answer.
But I mean, so let me just, because like people are watching this and it's like, they're thinking in their head, probably what I'm thinking. You're saying, you know, you should eat like every 1 to 2 hours carbs?
No, not 1 to 2 hours. No, I would say food takes time to digest. So There's what we call intestinal motility. And we know a lot about intestinal motility, that fat-free foods move through the digestive system the quickest. And you have to consider things like glycogen load, not glycogen index. That's ridiculous. The ridiculous things I've heard about glycogen index make me roll my eyes. Like, you can't eat carrots because they're high in glycogen index.
Yeah.
Look, nobody ever got fat from eating too many carrots. Nobody ever got fat from eating too many carrots.
You go by glycogen index. Snickers bars are healthier than watermelon.
Yeah, like let's, yeah. So, I mean, it's about glycogen load, which people don't
so,
know.
So give me an example. You wake up in the morning. I'm assuming you're not eating at night, right? You're not eating at night.
Sure, that's an old myth too. It's, I mean, again, those three realms of time. Oh, I read I can't eat after 7. Well, why did you read that? That doesn't, maybe it applies to you, maybe it doesn't. Most of my clients eat something right before bed. Why? Because quality of sleep has been shown, especially in recent research, over and over and over and over again to have direct effects on weight control and body weight balance. So if you're trying to not eat after dinner and you don't go to bed for another 6 hours and you're going to bed hungry, guess what? You don't have the neurotransmitters in your brain that invite sleep. Sleep isn't something you force, it's something you invite. So you invite sleep by eating certain things. See, this is where metabolism is more than the sum of its parts. It's more than, ooh, how many calories did you eat in the day? Ooh, how many carbs are in that? No, it's about what do specific foodstuffs actually do? Well, we know certain foods will trigger serotonin and other neurotransmitters in the brain to help you relax and invite sleep. So most of my clients, they eat something deliberately immediately before bed. I have been doing that for 3 decades. I'm about to be 56 years old. I've been lean for 3 decades by practicing that. So there's more to it. So it's energy balance throughout the day, but then understanding there's more to it. You got to consider the three realms of time, the immediate, the residual, and the cumulative, right? So what can my body, if I'm following the regimen I'm following right now, is this sustainable, not 12 weeks from now, 12 months from now, 12 years from now? And like I said, I've been on the cycle diet, which has regular cheat days. I've been on that for 3 decades.
Okay. And your book kind of outlines specifics as to what you're eating.
Yeah. There's not just a book. There's a whole course on it. And then, like I said, my protege, we did a project together called Abs by Andy, absbyandy.com. His favorite routines for his 8-pack abs is he's got really freaky abs that he maintains year round. But in that, he also goes to his specific lifestyle, which is different than mine. He's 20 years younger. So he talks about, he shows, I mean, even in the intro clip, it's kind of funny. You see him with the 6-pack abs, and then you see some cover shots of the magazines he was on. And then in the next intro clip, you see him mowing down on a pizza, right? So it shows him like indulging in his cheat days, which is part of maintaining an optimized metabolism so that he can stay lean. Mm-hmm. So different for him, different for me.
Okay. So, I mean, I'm very curious, definitely, to read a book. I'm sure a lot of listeners. But can you tell me how often are you having one of those cheat meals? Is that once a day, once every 3 days? How often?
Oh, my God. No. A regular underfeeding, you have to get into super compensation mode. So, you know, I talk in my book about a lot of people who have what we call tremendous wish bias in the industry. If that's not a term your listeners are familiar with, they should get familiar with it. Wish bias is how this industry works. You know, you'll hear a lot of very overweight people out at a restaurant. Oh, it's my cheat day. Like I had a client write me when I was writing the book. And there's a course too. The cycle.diet is an actual course that walks people through diet days, super compensation mode, all of that stuff. But I had a client who used to be with Weight Watchers, and she wrote me one day. She was out with all her Weight Watcher friends, and they were all ordering like drinks and, you know, fries and dessert. And it was okay because it was their quote unquote cheat day. Well, no, that's not okay because you're not in the right metabolic profile of super compensation mode. Therefore, when you overfeed, you're going to have that insulin dump. And because you're overweight, you're in fat storing mode, not fat burning mode. So you're going to shunt those extra calories into fat stores and get bigger and bigger. So you have to first create the metabolic environment. And what I always say is metabolism can be trained. People just don't realize it, and they don't have the patience to do it. Mm-hmm. So people want the magic trick, even though they say they're above that and they don't believe in it, that's exactly what they want. So first you train your metabolism. So in the old days when I was in my prime in the bodybuilding world, like 260 pounds at 5'9", you know, guest posing and all that stuff, I would have a full cheat day and a half cheat day. I've moved away from using the term cheat day because I found it has too many psychological ramifications for people with food issues and eating issues. So I just call it refeeds. But now that I'm older, in my 50s, that also has a pronounced effect on metabolism. Metabolism starts to slow down in your 50s, and so does biochemical responses. They tend to get a bit disrupted and dysfunctional. So now I have my cheat day just once a week on Sundays. But I have amazing refeeds, like pretty, you know, for my age, I can't eat like Andy, because Andy's an eating machine on his eat days. But I can still, you know, I can sit down to 2 liters of ice cream or a dozen donuts, no problem. Right. Wow. And I don't get, and you don't get fat from that. That's the thing. And people are like, well, what do you mean you don't, you know? Oh, and then the other thing, of course, is the orthorexic tree huggers out there. Well, that can't be healthy. It's like, well, yeah, it can be, because I get regular health checks all the time, and so does Andy. And so, you know, there's this element the fitness industry refuses to accept, and that's the world we live in. We live in a world of constant food abundance. We can't pretend to ignore that and have an attitude that the diet industry wants us to adopt, like, ooh, I'm never going to eat birthday cake again, or I'm never going to have this again until I reach my magic weight loss number. We don't live in that world. We live in a world of food abundance, and trying to ignore that. One of the exercises I got my ladies to do in my Empowered Woman course was to go to the grocery store, buy any green vegetable that they eat on their diet, and then buy their favorite indulgent food, whatever it was, like carrot cake, donuts, cheesecake. And I wanted them to come home, put the green veggie on the counter right beside their favorite indulgent food. Let's say it's carrot cake. And then have it somewhere where they would have to walk by it several times per day. And then make a note every time they walk by that of which one they would rather have. And over the course of 4 days, if they were being honest, of course the one you would rather have is the one that tastes the best. But if you keep trying to lie to yourself that, no, I want the asparagus. No, you don't. The reward centers of your brain are always going to orient to being rewarded. Right? The opioid centers of your brain are always going to orient toward an opiate response. That's why we're driven for sex. That's why we're driven for all kinds of things, right? It's hardwired into our brain to want to see food and enjoy food. Watch any mammal in the wild hunt for food. I mean, it's a hard drive into their head. So the first thing you have to do is get people to accept that, yeah, I really do like indulgent foods, and that's okay. You got to start there rather than with the denial. Start with the acceptance, and then do what Dan John says, learn from there to eat like an adult, and then continue from there. So with my cycle diet, what I say is on diet days, you eat like an adult, and on your refeed days, eat like a carefree kid.
So Coach, I got two quick questions for you on the cycle diet. So basically the cycle diet is 6 days of the week. You are
for where I'm at.
Okay. So for a certain number of days per week, depending on, you know, your age, metabolism, all that sort of thing, you eat in a calorie deficit, and then you have a refeed day, and then you go back to the calorie deficit.
Yeah. For some people, it might be a refeed meal, depending on super compensation mode has a depth to it. So you could be just flirting with super compensation mode, which means you would just have a cheat meal maybe. Or you could be deep into super compensation mode like Andy that I mentioned, and you guys should probably post pictures of Andy when you post this, and people will see just like, wow, that guy's ripped. And then yes, you go back to your regular diet days. So, but meanwhile, when you go back to your regular diet days, you've got that situational hypermetabolic effect from the spike, right? So you're now burning calories at a really higher level than you normally would be. All right. And then that lasts for a few days. And the other thing they do is they'll monitor their weight every 6 days. So as long as their weight comes back to where it was before their last refeed, then they take the next refeed. And usually that's what enhances weight loss, is actually taking the refeed. Again, in this industry, being as misguided as it is, what happens is people plateau in weight loss. And everyone seems to think that's unnatural. No, that's built into our body systems. Our body is always going to, the human being species survived by protecting against weight loss and knowing how to put on fat for times of starvation back in the old hunter-gatherer days, okay? So we are always up against it in terms of our own evolution and our own biology. What happens is people reach weight loss plateaus, and what's the normal response from their trainer or their coach? Cut their calories. When almost always what's going to reboot that system is just like rebooting your computer. Your computer's got a bug in it. You don't say just work slower. You say reboot your computer. Well, how do you do that? You restart it. Well, if your weight loss has plateaued and it stayed there and you're eating the exact same calories and not cheating, that's almost always an indicator for a calorie spike. To go out and just have at her and then come back and watch what happens. You've actually rebooted your system and the weight starts coming off again.
So just like in a snapshot of time, after your refeed day, your weight after that refeed day, later that day, it would go up, correct?
Oh yeah, you're gonna hold water, yeah. Things
like that. But then the next day, it should come back off, and that will give you an indicator if you're actually in that mode you're talking about.
So well, the next, it can come off almost immediately. It can come off over the next few days. There's other things like, again, biofeedback is what I'm all about, right? Inside out cues, not outside in cues. So not just your weight coming down, but does your hunger rate go back to normal? Does your appetite go back to normal? So if people say, well, I gained 8 pounds from my cheat day and it's 3 days later and I'm still up 8 pounds, then they're probably not in super compensation mode. And if they say, well, I'm really not hungry for my meals after my cheat day, most people will have their cheat day and then they'll write me, my clients anyway, and they'll say, I can't believe I'm hungry again, like I was last week, like I just ate a massive amount of food, but I'm hungry again. And it's like, okay, then you're in hypermetabolic mode, which is the best fat burning mode to be in. So we monitor things like biofeedback, and that's essential, right? Rather than outside in stuff that we started this conversation with, I try to orient people toward understanding their body's biofeedback, because there's no more honest thing than the way your body communicates with you. And the problem in this industry is we tend to tell everyone, just ignore what your body's communicating with you and listen to outside in stuff. Like eat this many calories no matter what your biofeedback is. No, your biofeedback's the one that's the truth.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Wait, so your biofeedback is what? Your the hunger you're feeling? What can you like extrapolate on that exactly?
Any scenarios coming from your body about anything, diet, training, like how many people now, along with this notion of starving themselves, they also have this modern notion that training is all about exhausting yourself. Well, when your body's trying to tell you it's exhausted, you don't ignore it and go to the gym and pound on it some more, mm-hmm. right? So we shouldn't
feel hungry, or we should?
Well, in my book, Beyond Metabolism, I outline the difference between what's called tolerable hunger, all right, and intolerable hunger. Oh, intolerable okay. hunger means you're in an absolute calorie deprivation mode, and that's a fat burning mode, and that's metabolically compromising. That's not good. In a relative calorie deficit, your mental acuity will still be sharp, but you'll know that you're hungry, right? And that's the state of all mammals in nature. All mammals in nature are constantly searching for food because they are in a tolerable hunger mode. Unless they're having to defend themselves or have sex, their drive is to pursue food, right?
Yeah. Anyone who has a dog knows every time I go to the kitchen, my dog follows me.
Yeah.
Why? Because she wants food. Yeah.
Right. And I've used the dog psychology thing a lot with people with food issues. That's another thing we can get into. But the difference in, you know, how to train your dog and stuff is very, very usable information for people with food issues and getting around seeing food as a negative thing. I mean, no dog ever looks at a garbage can as something absolutely putrid and, you know, like, ugh, that's just awful, right? So that we have mammals that, you know, are looking for food. Food is a reward. Food calms them down. Food lights up the reward centers of the brain, what's known as the opioid centers, right? And this is all well documented. I talked about this mostly in my book, Beyond Metabolism, which is about all this stuff, right? Why it's nonsense to have, if it fits your macros, because if you have a 100 calorie Snickers bar and you're prone to it, because there's it's shown it varies between individuals, but if you're prone to this and that lights up the reward centers of your brain, then you're going to go seeking a bigger reward eventually. Like you're going to, it's not going to be enough to have the 100 calorie Snickers. You're going to want the full Snickers bar. And then how long do you go on before your guard has just been lowered so much that, you know, you just capitulated? Not to mention doing all the math, like, you know what I mean? Losing weight and keeping weight off and being healthy and optimized and robust, you shouldn't require a math degree to do that. And it shouldn't require hours per day with a calculator in front of you. I find that stuff absolutely ridiculous. And again, looking down the road, can I do this 5 years from now? And the better question is, will I want to do this 5 years from now? So there's a study in came out in the new year from Pittsburgh, University of Pittsburgh. And it was all about everything I've been saying all along, that the over-quantification with things like FitPal and stuff actually demotivated people over time. They actually lost interest because of trying to pony up to numbers. Yeah. So I think a lot of this boils down.
You don't want to do homework every night or all the time. You
know? Yeah, and you know, eventually we want to be like other mammals. I mean, does your dog enjoy his snack?
Does he have an app where he tracks what he's eating? If he goes outside and eats a bug, does he track it down?
You know? Yeah, but plain and simple, does he have a look of calm and enjoyment when he eats? Of course they do, right? And our mammalian brain is exactly the same, okay? So we need to understand that. And I think where I differ from the industry so much is I teach people how to listen to their own body, because they're so confused by being told not to listen to it as an adult that they don't even understand their body speaking a different language as far as they're concerned. Might as well be Chinese. Whereas I'm like, no, your body speaks the language you're meant to understand. Let's get you back in tune with that. So along those lines, one of my ableisms that I've quoted is that people need to understand, and the way I got to the top of the industry and remain there is your body's meant to be your lifelong partner, not your lifelong project. And there's a difference in that line of thinking. If I self-nurture and self-respect, part of that is self-discipline, right? If I self-hate and self-reject, then part of that is a body that I'm never satisfied with. And guess what? You don't solve that issue.
It's funny because we had Frank Zane on the podcast a few days ago. And okay. He kind of has your mentality, because he says that you should never overtrain or train to failure, because he said that psychologically it makes no sense to punish ourselves. And that's what people do. I think when it comes to training, people do that. Now, a lot of people are watching, unfortunately, they have like substance abuse problems. I know we don't have much time on the show, but I kind of want to get your thoughts on that. Because if someone has an addiction, say alcohol or cocaine or heroin, and their brain is telling them, I want cocaine, heroin, and alcohol, what is the difference between that and the way you approach food?
Well, I mean, a lot of people have food issues, right? I've written books about it. And we call food issues the soft addictions, but people with these issues, they hate that term. And as far as they're concerned, an addiction is an addiction is an addiction. So there's a free book on my website at Scott Abel Fitness, Mindset of Achievement, where I break down a lot of these elements. When you have someone with, now there's a difference between substance abuse, substance dependency, and full out physiological addiction. Those things are all in kind of different categories. But what's happened is I call these maladaptive coping strategies. In other words, they started for one reason, to meet an immediate impulse, usually emotional release or emotional relief. Oh, I'm so stressed, I can't deal. I've been fighting with my husband for weeks and weeks and weeks. I'll just a glass of wine tonight, you know, that kind of, it starts off innocently enough, but it's acting on impulse. So we call that a maladaptive coping behavior, because it eventually becomes a maladaptive coping strategy. What does that mean? It means not only now do you use substance to avoid emotional fitness issues, but now you've got two problems. You've got the initial precipitating problem that you're trying to seek emotional relief from, but now you've got the additional substance problem as well. So now you've got a twofold depth of problem, which we see a lot in ladies that I deal with food issues, right? And ironically enough, I have to say this on almost every podcast I'm on, the people that I help with food issues the first thing I have to help them with is stop thinking this is a diet issue, right? Oh, I think I want to hire you for a diet. I've got all these food issues and I binge eat and I do all these things and I want to buy a diet from you. I'm like, a diet from me or from anyone else doesn't solve that. That's a mindset thing, right? And I always say quality of mindset determines quality of behavior. So the solutions actually start in the mind with things like cognitive reframing, cognitive restructuring. These are things that are all outlined in my book, Beyond Metabolism, for people with these kinds of issues. But we have to also recognize for people with substance issues, once they become habit, we need to understand that a habit is an automatic neural event. That's how it's actually defined. Automatic means we develop something as a habit, so we don't have to think about it. We don't have to concentrate on it. It becomes a habit thing. That's why these habits are maladaptive coping strategies, because they produce more problems than they solve. So the old saying there is, it takes a habit to break a habit. So that's an important thing too. And my co-host on my podcast, he's the habit guy. He's the guy to talk to about that, because he's just written a book all about that. But one of the things I say is a lot of people's thinking strategies are actually stinking tragedies. They don't trace their own thought patterns to see where it leads them. So in other words, they'll keep saying things like, oh my God, why do I keep binge eating? I don't want to do this. I keep binge eating. Like, I hate this. I hate myself. And why do I keep doing this? All they've done there is set their brain to keep answering the same question over and over, which is going to make them repeat the same behavior over and over, because your brain thinks that's what you want it to do. So it works at the level of the problem. And as Einstein always said, a problem is never solved at the level of thinking that causes it. So instead, they should be thinking, what's a solution to this? What's an alternative to this? Set their brains and their minds to working towards something rather than trying to fight against. Set your brain to working toward what you do want, and stop setting it toward trying to fight against what you don't want. And that's what separates a lot of people in terms of reaching their goals, sustaining their goals, or never reaching them, and just going through that cycle of weight loss and gain over and over again.
So, Coach, we're already over our hour here. Yeah. I can't believe it's already been an hour. This just flew by. This has been a great episode. I know I'm going to re-listen to this a couple times. You dropped a lot of knowledge gems for our listeners. Anyone who hasn't heard of Andy Sinclair, Google his name. I mean, he looks amazing. I can't believe the guy eats pizza and ice cream once a week. I'm actually going to, after the show, I'll send him an email and see if he wants to come on the show so we can talk a little bit more about his Abs by Andy program.
Yeah, and I think people will like him. He's just a really nice kid. Well, kid to me, but this week I know he's diving into a 3-pound drum of double chocolate chip cookie dough, and it was funny because when I have him, we started this thing a while back, the Coach and Andy Show on my YouTube channel, and the first time I had him on, I'm always like, okay, lift up your shirt, you know, like show the ladies, like, you know, that kind of, he's guy candy for sure, right? So, people would write in, well, how long did he cut his water before you did this? And you know, how many days ago did he cut his carbs? And I'm like, no. He looks like this 24/7, 365, and he's looked like this for 13 years.
Jeez. So, yeah. I mean, you do those Facebook Live videos every single week, and I mean, he looks the same every single week. So, I mean, this isn't, you know, a couple photo shoots he had that, you know, you're just reusing photos. No, this is proof is in the pudding. Cause I mean, you're showing this every single week.
Yeah. And that's why I like the Abs by Andy project. Cause he's there like on, you know, he's filming his cheat day. He's eating a pizza right in front of you with, full 6-pack abs on display. You know what I mean? So it just, and he's been doing my cycle diet for 13 years. So that's the sustainability factor, right?
So Coach, I'm about to close up the show now. I know a lot of our listeners are going to be curious to learn more about your cycle diet. Where can they purchase your books and where can they learn more about, you know, your nutrition plans, your training programs, things like that?
Well, I try to make my training programs and diet plans fit the person instead of having the person fit the programs. So that's the individual thing about one-on-one coaching. They can find all my books at scottablefitness.com. They can find a lot of my books on Amazon. the Cycle Diet book is on both Amazon and my website, but there's also a course, the cycle.diet, no.com, just the cycle, one word, .diet. There was so much demand from the Cycle Diet book being number one and everything, like, you know, can you give us more, give us more? So we turned it into an actual course. So, and that outlines, I mean, you know, can't get more detailed than that. It tells people how to start their diet days, what to look for in terms of biofeedback, what is supercompensation mode, why does it matter, those kind of things.
So, and is the course, how much does this course cost, or is it?
It's all on the website. I don't even look at that stuff anymore. Okay. That's up to my business manager. I just put out the content because that's kind of my end of things. I'm sure you guys can dig that up.
I'll have all that in the link in the podcast description, so you guys don't have to worry about writing that down. Next week we got Skip LaCour booked, but I'll send an email to Andy right now and see if he wants to come on the following week. Coach, we really appreciate you coming on. This is a great episode. For your host, Trevor Caritzen, for my co-host, Steve Smee, and for our special guest, Coach Scott Abel, this has been another episode of Evolutionary Radio. Live your life, look good doing it. Thanks for listening. Thank you.